Good morning, everyone. Hope you all had a good night's sleep.
Yes, thank you.
Good. I don't know how well you can see the TV. I'll only be using it for a couple of minutes. And I'll sort of move this in the way, out of the way. But yeah, can everyone sort of see the TV well enough? Yeah.
We'll hear it, won't we?
Yeah, I mean, so it's only for a couple of minutes. It's not, nothing too much. Right, okay, so welcome to the Saturday morning hangover slot. the subject is policing the protests. Often, a protest is remembered more for how the police responded to it than what the protest was actually about. Images of kettle demonstrators and cops with riot shields, raised batons and tear gas tend to stick in the memory. But protests aren't only policed in such overt ways. The state has ways of managing protests before they've even begun. Legislation can shape where and how a protest takes place, as well as how protesters are dealt with. The first part of my talk will cover some of the laws most relevant to protesting. I'll start with the Human Rights Act 1998, which incorporated parts of the European Convention on Human Rights, allowing the right to protest. So it's nice to think that we've been given the right to protest by our lords and masters above. However, the Public Order Act 1986 is used against protesters who behave violently, or in the eyes of the law, have the potential to act violently. And of course, this could be interpreted to apply to any protester or anyone sort of in the area of a protest. You know, you could say that anyone has the potential to act violently. The 1994 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act could be seen as a turning point in the way the state regarded protests. The Act was a response to several trends around in the late 80s and early 90s, such as rave culture, the poll tax riots and direct action, especially by animal rights activists and environmentalists. The most relevant feature of this Act was Part 5, which covered trespassing on land by large numbers of people, and therefore applied both to rave events and groups such as hunt saboteurs. The Act attracted significant opposition, not only from protesters, but also by bands and DJs threatened by the restrictions on raves and free festivals. The Crime and Disorder Act 1998 introduced, among other measures, the ASVO. Antisocial behaviour orders are issued by magistrates to those judged to have behaved inappropriately in public, including during protests. These orders restrict behaviour, such as going to particular areas. There are plans to replace ASVOs with alternative so-called community-based social control policies, whatever that means. Part 11 of the Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Act 2001 included regulations expecting mobile phone companies and internet service providers to retain information. And the new Communications and Data Bill will expand on this and allow the police and security services to keep track of who is calling who on mobile phones, anyone's email addresses, and the personal IDs of people using social networking websites. Mobile phone companies and internet service providers will be expected to store this information, which could later be accessed by the police. And this is relevant to protests because it could be used to trace the contacts of those who organise protests over the internet. The Serious Organised Crime and Police Act 2005 included restrictions on protests within a 1 kilometre radius of Parliament Square in London. This was brought in partly to deal with just one individual, and I don't know if he felt flattered that a whole law was being brought in just for him, but a chap called Brian Hoare started up his own peace camp in Parliament Square to protest against protest. Protest against war. He lived there from 2001 until his death in 2011, aged 62. And during his protest, he frequently found himself in court or involved in disputes with the police. The Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act 2011 replaced sections of the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act and amended the restrictions on protest around Parliament Square. Had he still been there, Brian Hoare would have found the act used against him straight away. According to Liberty, the human rights organisation, and I'll quote, the provisions in the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act 2011 are thought to have been introduced to do with a specific issue of protest encampments on the Parliament Square Garden, and were motivated by a desire to create a visually aesthetic area in the lead-up to to big public events like the Royal Wedding in April 2011 and the 2012 Olympics. These new restrictions are likely to lead to similar problems to those experienced under the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act. However, this law wasn't used to clear the Occupy camps later on. Instead, the Highways Act 1980 was invoked, as it legislates against obstructing highways, which the Occupy camps were accused of doing. Alongside this legislation, there are several strategies devised by the police to deal with what they would call extremist groups. In particular, there is the PREVENT strategy, which was launched in 2007. It seeks, and I'll quote, to stop people becoming terrorists or supporting terrorism. It is the preventative strand of the government's counter-terrorism strategy contest. And section 3.6 of this associates terrorism with, and I'll quote, a rejection of a cohesive, integrated, multi-faith society and of parliamentary democracy. Groups which reject these values could therefore find themselves targeted by the police. But you could ask why am I mentioning anti-terrorism legislation in a talk about protests. And but although the strategy is aimed at religious extremists, it could apply to secular political groups. And the SPGB, and I'm sure virtually everyone on the left are involved in anarchism, would never advocate any of the aims or methods of terrorism, but that the state might not be able to make the distinction between terrorists and revolutionaries or even lefties, and that's where potentially this this act could be worrying. There's a danger that, for example, possessing some political texts could be used as evidence by the police in the same way that terrorist texts are. As far as I'm aware, this hasn't happened yet, but there are still some people concerned about this, including an organisation called the Network for Police Monitoring, or NETPOL. But if you're a protester, in my opinion, there are other aspects of the police that you've got more reason to be suspicious of than the sections which deal with terrorism. The Special Demonstration Squad was formed in 1968 as a special branch of the Metropolitan Police to infiltrate protest groups. It's thought that far-right, far-left and anarchist groups have all been infiltrated. Restructuring of the Metropolitan Police led to the closure of the Special Demonstration Squad in 2008. And then a similar function was performed by the National Public Order Intelligence Unit. The Guardian newspaper described its remit as to gather, assess, analyse and disseminate intelligence and information relating to criminal activities in the United Kingdom where there is a threat of crime or to public order which arises from domestic extremism or protest activity. Part of this unit, called the Confidential Intelligence Unit, contains a database of protesters and their activities. The National Public Order Intelligence Unit was by far the largest of three little-known so-called domestic extremism units, working under the direction of the National Coordinator for Domestic Extremism. And he's got about 100 staff and a budget of over $8 million a year. The second unit, out of the three that were grouped together, was known as the National Extremism Tactical Coordination Unit. I'm fed up with these long names of different organisations. This one was established in 2004, and it gave out advice to police forces, companies, universities and other organisations to cope with protests with the potential to be unlawful. The third unit was the National Domestic Extremism Team. And these three units have been rebranded the National Domestic Extremism Unit, again, slightly similar to one of the teams within that unit, and brought under the responsibility of the Metropolitan Police. But what I'll do next is I'll focus on the methods of the Special Demonstration Squad and its successor, the National Public Order Intelligence Unit. And these have been investigated by the Guardian newspaper. And in particular, it has reported extensively on alleged undercover police working within radical groups. So far, seven undercover police who have infiltrated protest groups have been exposed. There will have been many more, as the highly secretive operation to monitor and disrupt political activists has been running for four decades. The following is what has been claimed by The Guardian. Police officer Mark Kennedy first adopted the false identity Mark Stone in 2003, when he was age 33. Before he was assigned to infiltrate protest groups, he was issued a fake driving licence and passports, which he later used to travel to around 22 countries. He made sure that his image was right. He grew his hair long, had tattoos and piercings. And he started by getting in contact with Earth First, which is a large direct action group which focuses on environmental issues. And in 2004, he became involved in Dissent, a network of protesters preparing for the upcoming G8 summit. But the following year, he scaled trees in London to hang a banner protesting against BP. Then in 2006, he became involved with the first annual climate camp gatherings, taking part in protests at power stations in Hartlepool and Didcot. He infiltrated several protest groups at dozens of demonstrations, up to the G20 protests in 2009. He joined anti-racist groups, anarchist groups, environmental groups and animal rights groups, despite eating meat. And his popularity within protest movements was shown when around 200 people turned up to his 40th birthday party. His fellow protesters said he rarely gave political opinions and instead focused on getting involved in the practical aspects of protests. It's been assumed that Mark tipped off the police about a planned protest at the Ratcliffe-on-Soar power station in Nottinghamshire in 2009. The day before the event, 114 activists were arrested. Mark was one of 27 charged with conspiracy to commit aggravated trespass. Mark declined to use the same law firm as the other protesters, and charges against him, one of the others, were dropped. Even if this didn't attract the suspicions of the groups he was involved in, his appetite for direct action did. And in their eyes, it seemed he was just too good a protester to be true. He was finally found out in 2010, after friends found a passport in his real name, and documents confirmed he'd been in the police since the mid-90s. Apparently, he first said that this was a fake passport he used when he was smuggling drugs. But later, apparently, he broke down in tears, confessed that he was an undercover policeman, and voiced regret for the pain he had caused. Mark Kennedy has now left the Metropolitan Police and moved abroad. He has said that he knew of 15 other undercover police working in environmental protest groups. Mark Kennedy seemed to be more than just a spy. His work in organising and participating in demonstrations led many to suspect that he was an agent provocateur. He was always at the centre of direct action protests, and it's been assumed that the money he contributed to protests came from police funds. It was his money and his resources, including a pickup truck, which helped him ingratiate himself with the activist group. The above has been adapted from a series of articles in The Guardian from January 2011 onwards. And after their publication, three official inquiries into Mark Kennedy's seven-year infiltration of protest groups was launched, and the Association of Chief Police Officers, ACPO, was stripped of its power to run undercover police units. And this coincided with the domestic extremism teams being transferred to the Metropolitan Police. Mark Kennedy himself denied allegations that he had formed any sexual relationships with protesters to gain information. ACPO did not deny that undercover police may have slept with their associates, but denied that this practice was official policy. One undercover policeman accused of using close relationships as part of their cover is a chap called Bob Lambert. He adopted the persona of Bob Robinson during over 20 years of infiltration. In the 1980s, Bob became involved in Greenpeace, and he later said he did this in order to gain the experience and credibility needed to infiltrate the Animal Liberation Front, the ALF. At this time, one of the ALF's tactics was to use explosives against the vivisection, meat and fur trades. I'm not defending the Animal Liberation Front or their methods at all. The point I'm making here is that in order to infiltrate them, Bob's cover story apparently included tricking women into relationships. As a party in 1987, Bob met Jenny, whose real name has been withheld by The Guardian. Bob told Jenny that he worked as a cash-in-hand gardener and a minicab driver. She described him as polite, considerate, very romantic, attentive, charismatic, with a high moral code.
Where is he?
after you've heard what happened next, you might not be. anyway, they began a relationship with Luck, which lasted 18 months. Jenny had no interest in the ALF, despite Bob encouraging her to attend their meetings. Although Jenny herself was not involved in activism, she only knew him by the identity he used to infiltrate the ALF. It's likely that he wanted to use her to gain credibility, as some protest groups are suspicious of people who turn up on their own. By this time, Bob was active within the highest ranks of the ALF. The organisation was targeted by the police following three bombings of department stores in the Home Counties. Following information passed on by Bob, police raided a flat in London and found two ALF members making bombs. After they were arrested, Bob managed to deflect any suspicions that he tipped off the police, and it seems that he even staged a mock police raid on Jenny's flat to maintain his integrity. Jenny wanted Bob to settle down and start a family, but he was reluctant. He said that he should flee abroad because the police were pursuing him as a dangerous radical. For a time, he stayed with friends of hers in what was believed to be a safe house where the police were less likely to find him. Towards the end of 1988, he entered the relationship and said that he was going to escape to Spain. Early in 1989, Jenny received a letter from him, postmarked from Valencia. This was another part of his ruse. His undercover tour was ending, so he needed to distance himself from those who his alter ego associated with. By the 1990s, Bob had been promoted and was leading the special demonstration squad. And he later went on to work in the Metropolitan Police's Muslim contact unit, set up to improve relations with Muslims after 2011. Jenny only discovered Bob's real identity in 2011, after his undercover work was exposed. When she found out about who he really was, Jenny said, "I was cruelly tricked and it has made me feel angry. I feel violated." Bob later gave an unreserved apology for developing the relationship with her as part of his cover story. According to The Guardian, in the mid-80s, just a year into his deployment, Lambert fathered a son with another woman he was sent to spy on. Lambert and the woman did not live together long, and afterwards he occasionally made visits. 2 years later, the mother married someone else, and Lambert no longer had any contact. In January 2012, The Guardian reported that another undercover policeman fathered a child with a protester and later disappeared from their lives. And this one allegedly followed the progress of his child and her mother by reading police reports into her activism. Apparently, Bob Lambert was already married during the time he was an undercover spy. In fact, being married is supposedly one of the requirements for members of the Special Demonstration Squad. And this was brought in after one of the squad's members decided to join the group he was infiltrating after a genuine conversion. It was judged that if an officer was married, then developing genuinely close relationships with protest groups would be less likely. In total, 8 women have started legal action against police chiefs on the ground that they unwittingly formed intimate long-term relationships with undercover police. They feel betrayed both personally and politically, as the men didn't have the political beliefs the women assumed they had. 4 of the relationships ended when the men suddenly disappeared, with some of the men going travelling or saying they needed to escape the police. The number of intimate relationships highlighted by the legal action casts doubt on the police's stance that relationships are not within the guidelines for undercover policing. John Murphy, the chief constable for Merseyside, told The Guardian in January 2011 that these relationships were never acceptable and were grossly unprofessional. He added that it is a diversion from what they are there to do. It is morally wrong because people have been put there to do a particular task and people have got to trust in them. So apparently having a relationship with somebody spying on is morally wrong, but spying on them is morally wrong. Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary has been conducting a review into the undercover policing of protesters, and this is one of 12 judicial inquiries into the issue. The planned publication of their report was abandoned in October 2011, when The Guardian and the BBC's Newsnight revealed that undercover officers may have lied in court, including by using their false identities. After their actions were exposed, Mark Kennedy and Bob Lambert both spoke out to criticise the undercover tactics they used. They also, to a greater or lesser extent, have voiced sympathy to the causes of the groups that they infiltrated. Now, if you're an optimist, you could say that after being shown two opposing ideologies, that of the police and that of the protesters, they realised that siding with the protesters was the more rational or reasonable option. But, or if you're more cynical, you could say that this is just one way of them avoiding retribution from the protest groups they tricked. But the damage has been done. The undercover police would have passed on to their superiors details of the groups they infiltrated and details of the people within them. This, alongside information gathered more openly by police during protests, means that the police have stored information about many individual protesters and radicals. For example, there's John and Linda Catt. John's an 85-year-old artist and Linda is his daughter. And they found out that the police had covertly recorded their presence at more than 80 demonstrations over 4 years, logging details such as their appearance and the slogans on their T-shirts. And they were labelled domestic extremists. While individuals should rightfully be wary of any information about them gathered by police, the SPGB doesn't need to be too concerned about infiltrators or surveillance. All our meetings and policies are open to the public, so an infiltrator couldn't gain any secret information anyway, as there isn't any to find. I just said that to put off any... as well as legislation and police strategies, there are other ways that the state influences protests before they've even begun. And the police aim to control crowds before they've converged. Protesters have been arrested on flimsy charges just before an event in order to get them out of the way. According to NetPol, the Network for Monitoring the Police, this happened at the Royal Wedding in April 2011, when dozens of people across London were arrested preemptively on the grounds that this would prevent a breach of the peace. Those arrested weren't part of a cohesive group, and they didn't have coherent aims. They included members of the Charing Cross 10, who were on their way to a Republican street party, the Starbucks zombies, who were arrested in an Oxford Street coffee shop for wearing zombie costumes, and a man who was simply walking in London until he was arrested by plainclothes officers because he was a known activist. All of them were released without charge once the public celebrations had finished. And on other occasions, when protesters have been charged with something and then released on bail, their bail conditions may restrict where they can go. And these tactics could be used to prevent would-be protesters from attending a demo, even if they haven't been found guilty of any crime. And of course, many other potential protesters might be deterred from going to an event because they fear arrest or police brutality. And I think this is one reason why the May Day demonstrations in London have been scaled back over the last 10 years. But during a march or a protest, the police use other, more physical tactics. Two sections of the police you're likely to see on the demo are forward intelligence teams and police support units. Forward intelligence teams are involved in overt surveillance using cameras, camcorders and audio recorders. They were first established in the early 90s when mobile surveillance equipment became more portable and affordable. There is some flexibility over how the information gathered by forward intelligence teams is used. Even Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary has criticised this. Their 2009 Adapting to Protest report said that this lack of clarity creates the potential for FIT officers to act outside their lawful powers. Police support units contain officers trained in dealing with incidents, including protests. And standard kit for PSU officers consists of a transparent acrylic riot shield, a baton, a visored NATO helmet, shin and elbow guards, and fireproof coverings when required. A police support unit consists of one inspector, three sergeants, 18 constables, two medics, and three van drivers. And the actions of police on protests have been under increased scrutiny since the rise of smartphones enables anyone to record what's happening on a protest. And you might remember the name Ian Tomlinson. On the day of the 2009 G20 summit protests, he was on his way home from working as a newspaper vendor in London. He wasn't involved in the protests, and he was walking alone with his hands in his pockets. Then he was hit from behind on the legs by a police officer wielding a baton, who then pushed him to the ground. The officer was later identified as PC Simon Harwood, although at the time he had allegedly hidden his identity by wearing a balaclava and removing his shoulder ID numbers. Tomlinson's reaction to being hit was puzzlement rather than anger. He walked away but collapsed and died later on that day. The incident was filmed by at least four bystanders, and footage was later forwarded onto The Guardian. Right, let's see if I can get this running. Disturbing footage. PC Harwood was connected with several other violent incidents on that day. And in his initial statement, he said that he doesn't remember how many people he struck with his baton and had forgotten Tomlinson was among them. He's been charged with manslaughter, and his trial has been going on this week. Remember that PC Harwood was accused of wearing a balaclava and removing the ID numbers on the shoulder of his uniform. On other protests, police have also allegedly concealed their identities so they can't be traced if their actions later raise complaints. And it's been reported as well that police swap ID numbers or their uniform type with each other. And this is so they can say that their unit was elsewhere if accused of wrongdoing. As well as batons, police on protests have also used chemical weapons. Pepper spray has its name because its active ingredient is derived from chili peppers. In the UK, a synthetic version is used, and it's normally sprayed from canisters. Tear gas has its name because it stimulates the corneal nerves in the eye to cause tears, pain and even blindness. CS gas is a type of tear gas. It can be sprayed from canisters or fired from grenade launchers. In January 2011, CS gas was used by the Metropolitan Police at a UK Uncut protest in London. A video shows a policeman apparently spraying a canister at close range at people near a woman who was being arrested for posting leaflets through a shop door. I did plan on showing the video of that, but it didn't come out properly. It wasn't recorded. Regarding tear gas, the following was written by Naomi Klein about a protest in Quebec in 2001. They filled entire neighbourhoods with tear gas, a substance that by definition does not discriminate, is indifferent to perimeters, protests or politics. The toxic fumes seeped into houses, forcing families to breathe through masks in their living rooms. Frustrated that the wind was against them, the police sprayed some more. People giving the peace sign to the police were gassed. People handing out food were gassed. I met a 50-year-old woman from Ottawa who told me cheerfully, "I went out to buy a sandwich and was gassed twice." People having a party under a bridge were gassed. People protesting against their friend's arrest were gassed. The first aid clinic treating people who had been gassed was gassed. Tear gas was supposed to break down the protesters, but it had the opposite effect. It enraged and radicalised them, enough to cheer for members of the Black Bloc anarchist contingent who dared to throw back the canisters. Gas may be light and atomised enough to ride on air, but I suspect the coming months will show that it has powerful bonding properties. Water cannons have been used during riots in Northern Ireland, but none are owned by police forces in mainland Britain yet. Their use has to be authorised by Parliament, but they're frequently used across Europe. A newer type of weapon is the long-range acoustic device. These send messages, warnings and harmful pain-inducing noises over longer distances than normal loudspeakers. They were ready to use when the Occupy Wall Street protest was cleared in November 2011, and it was confirmed by the Ministry of Defence in May that they will be in London during the Olympics. One has been seen fixed to a landing craft on the Thames. A Ministry of Defence spokesman said, "As part of the military contribution to the police-led security effort to ensure a safe and secure Games, a broad range of assets and equipment is being used by our armed forces. This includes the long-range acoustic device, which will be deployed during the Olympic Games, primarily to be used in the loud hailer mode, as part of the measures to achieve a maritime stop on the Thames." Plastic bullets haven't been fired by police on mainland Britain, but they nearly were during last year's mindless riots in London. And in development are guns which fire different types of projectiles, including sticky foam and nets, similar to those used against wild animals. Also possible are so-called active denial systems, which is a euphemism for a device which directs high-frequency microwave radiation, which boils the water in your skin. As well as physical weapons, police manage protests with deliberate positioning of both them and the protesters. And this aspect of policing reminds me of a picture book showing medieval soldiers in different attack formations. When front-facing a protest, officers usually group together in a line running opposite to the front row of protesters, and snatch squads of police which then charge forward in a V-shaped formation to target prominent protesters. Trying to choreograph a protest also means that the movements of the protesters have to be managed and restricted. And the most well-known method of doing this is called kettling. Kettling, also known as containment or corralling, is usually used in urban areas. Large numbers of police strategically block roads, enabling them to direct the protesters along designated streets or hold them in one area. This method means that it's easy enough for passers-by to be contained, as well as demonstrators. And it seems that kettling was first used in the mid-80s and has often been used since. I was kettled on a May Day protest about 10 years ago, and I found this tactic isn't just a way of police controlling where you are, it's a form of psychological warfare. Not being able to choose where to go stirs up a confusing feeling of anger and fear. And also, when people are kettled for hours on end, they either become desperate for the toilet or tired, and both of which can demoralise people. On the protest I was on, several people escaped by either feigning illness or genuinely passing out. The legality of kettling was challenged by two people who were on the 2009 G20 protests in London. They were, among others, contained by police for over 4 hours in Bishopsgate. They won a High Court ruling which states that there was no evidence of an imminent breach of the peace to justify the kettle. However, this was later overturned when the Metropolitan Police won its appeal. The Met said that the kettling was necessary to prevent violent protesters from hijacking a police camp attended by up to 5,000 people. Kettling was also challenged by four protesters restrained during a protest in London in 2001. They waited 10 years for their case to be heard by the European Court of Human Rights, and they argued they'd been deprived of their right to liberty under Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights. They lost the case, with the judges concluding that kettling was the least intrusive and most effective means to be applied, and that the protesters' liberty hadn't been compromised. And the judges also said they found no reason to distinguish between peaceful protesters and other members of the public caught up inside the police cordon. This shows that the state is willing and able to justify itself using its own legislation. Even though the state allows for complaints and inquiries against the tactics used by the police, nothing substantial really changes as a result of them. In fact, as we've seen, the trend is for the use of force and infiltration to increase over the years. One inquiry was Adapting to Protest, published by Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary in 2009. This report talks about the British policing model as ensuring, quote, the safety of the public and the preservation of the police within a tolerant plural society. It places a high value on tolerance and winning the consent of the public. The report apparently acknowledged that the police had failed to use the British policing model successfully and consistently. The failings they noted have been the excessive use of force, officers not understanding the law, different practices across police forces, inappropriate use of stop and search, and a lack of accountability for how protests are policed. The aim stated in the report is to facilitate peaceful protest, that's a quote, with the public being aware in advance of likely police tactics. And these tactics include the following, quoted from the report. The techniques available to the officer include communication, both verbal and non-verbal, unarmed skills including distraction, see below, baton skills and the use of incapacitant sprays. All the techniques used have been the subject of independent medical review and validated through a group of practitioners before approval by the ACPO Self-Defence Arrest and Restraint Committee, which includes representatives from the Home Office and Independent Police Complaints Commission. Forces are bound to ensure that only the techniques contained in the manual are taught to force personnel. Unarmed skills include fist, elbow, back of hand, palm and heel palm strikes amongst others. Baton skills include parrying and strikes to the side of the body and the leg. Both sets of skills can be used as distraction techniques against an aggressor, thereby giving the officer a window of opportunity in which to apply better control. In MPS officer safety training, this is specifically to make a subject release their grip on someone or something, or to help apply handcuffs. And as we saw in the video, those skills were in operation against Ian Tomlinson. So the purpose of this report isn't really to create kinder police officers. Instead, it aims to create a more cohesive police force to use against protesters by increasing training, clarity and consistency. So we've looked at the legislation the state uses to manage protests and also which aspects of the police target protesters. And as we've heard, the police's methods include undercover officers sent to infiltrate several direct action groups. And when policing a protest, the police are using brutal and manipulative tactics to control the crowds. This ongoing game of tit-for-tat between police and protesters may be a battle in the class war, but it has little to do with genuine revolutionary activity. This is essentially an arms race. Protesters come up with new strategies, such as coordinating protests through social networking sites, and this is counteracted by new legislation and increased police surveillance. While protesters may often have the strength of numbers, the police have strength through the law and state-sanctioned violence. A protest is just an opportunity for the police and the state to find new ways to undermine and control other protests in the future. Thank you.